Hey everybody, you are listening to Nocturnal Distractions. I am your host, Kendra, and we are going to continue on with this series that I am having a heck of a time with right now. So start off by apologizing again for the long lag or whatever time period between the last episode and this episode, just because they're hard to find information on, and I will kind of get into why this first kind of section on this the gradations of evil scale are they're harder to find information on. The first one was harder to find information on because it was a justifiable homicide, and you just don't hear about them that often. They don't make news headlines. They're not, unfortunately, we all know how the news works. We all know how they look for what is considered, I can't even think of the word right now, sensationalized. They look for sensationalized news, right? Something that's going to grab people's attention and draw them in. It's going to sell more papers, going to sell more magazines, going to have more people tune in to their newscast, etc. So something that's a justifiable homicide is not going to cut it, you know? And so finding information on those kind of cases is a little difficult when I don't have the number of resources that a lot of larger podcasts, I guess, have. Just because I don't have the funding to be subscribing to a bunch of different magazines or websites that give me access to a bunch of different cases and case information. So, anywho's, let's just jump into here. I know I had two of them. I had two different cases to begin with, and this is just going to be one of them, because I'm not sure if I'm going to cover the second one, honestly, within this section. It might actually get moved down a couple of levels. After I read through it a little bit more, I might be moving that one down. So this is probably going to be the only one for this level. And you guys can hear about Gerald Strickland a little bit later on in this whole series we got going here. So in the last episode, I did cover a case that fit into level one on the 22 level gradations of evil scale, which was justifiable homicide. In this episode, I will be moving on to level two, which are kind of more of the impulsive jealousy murders, so to speak. So impulsive jealousy murders aren't just something that you think of as happening in modern day times of like internet and social media, where somebody like catches their significant other or partner, you know, cheating by seeing something on their phone or going through their messages, you know, or phone conversations or whatever that are going to be taken the wrong way, you know, or there's phone conversations that get taken out of context, or just plain hookups that are made easy by dating apps and the anonymity of online connections. So we tend to think of sometimes these jealousy, impulsive jealousy murders as being almost a modern day crime. But, you know, jealousy murders and killings are basically as old as human race itself. Because even though societally, like, we've come a long way from our ancestors when it comes to like jealousy, because it used to be if somebody killed in jealousy, it was because it was a protection of like their genetics and them being able to reproduce and continue the species on and that type of a thing. You didn't want your mate, so to speak, to be stepping out on you. However, just because societally we've come a ways from that mentality does not mean that our brains have evolved to the point of wanting to not protect that continuity of our genetics. And so therefore our brains can react with that sudden violence when faced with the fact or even a hint of the betrayal of our significant other or our partner. So like I said, even though in societally we've come a long ways from ancestor, you know, way, way back when human race ancestors and the jealousy murders of then, our brains themselves have not completely evolved from like that heat of the moment, in the moment, like snap decision of anger and stuff. Which leads us into basically category or level. I kind of intermix between level and category, so you'll hear me using both again. Leveler category 2 on the gradations of evil scale, which is jealous lovers who are egocentric, which means that they think only of themselves and have no regard or feelings for others. They're self-centered, immature people who commit crimes of passion. So this is where you'll hear of anytime you hear like somebody who's committed a crime of passion, like a lot of the times this is where it'll fit into. Not always, as I found when researching, because there's different variations, there's different levels of a crime of passion. You can have a crime of passion, but still have it be something that is premeditated or something that is with malice. And this is one that's like, it's committed, it's a crime of passion, but there's no premeditation and there's no malice. And in other words, they don't overkill type of a thing. They're not torturing the other person. It's fairly quick most of the time, and it's impulsive, very impulsive. And they don't think about what to do afterwards until after it's done. So I had originally had the two different cases to tell you about, but since I'm only covering one of them, you know, I might get to the other case. It might be a Patreon, or I guess not even a Patreon anymore, because I decided to do away with that. It'll be a buy me a coffee subscription only episode, because it took me a while to even find these two cases, because it's difficult, as it was, like I said, in level one, to find the information on these killings, because they're not premeditated and they're not committed with malice. And this is mainly due to the fact that, you know, like I said, in these cases, they're not seen as overly vicious or evil and are not widely covered in mainstream news. Unfortunately, this also means that I'm not going to have a lot of background information on either the killer or the victim in this case, just because the information is not as widely available as it will be with cases that come later on in this series, when we get to the ones that are more vicious, that are premeditated, that are the serial killers, that are the torturers. You get more information on their backgrounds because they are studied more than somebody who just does a one-time killing, one and done type of a thing. Not saying that's okay, but that's what these types of killings are. So I'm gonna take us back in time. This is, I don't want to say this is appropriate, but it is Valentine's Day right now, so I guess a jealous lover killing kind of makes sense in a way to be recording and having it come out today. But we're going to go back into August 30th, 1931 in Kingsburg, California. This is a town that resided within the county of Fresno, California. And Kingsburg itself is located about 21 miles from Fresno, the city, and about 130 miles from the California Central Coast and the Sierra Nevada mountain range. The population of Kingsburg in the 1930s was about 1,300 people. And I don't think when I looked it up that it's gone up a whole lot since then. Has some, not a lot, so still a pretty small town. So on August 30th, 1931, 15-year-old orphan Jesus Borja was looking for love, and he thought he had found it with the 13-year-old Rosa, although I'm going to call her Rosa, but in some articles I found the information from, it called her Rose. Like it went back and forth. The newspaper articles went back and forth between Rose and Rosa. I'm just going to use Rosa. So just an FYI there. Rosa Guerrero. So he thought that he had found love with 13-year-old Rosa Guerrero. Jesus Borja became smitten with the girl, of whom was of Mexican descent, while he was residing with some of her relatives in the same house as she lived. So they both lived in the same house, but he was not obviously related to her. And they kind of had like this little, what we would consider nowadays like a puppy love type of a thing going on. But, you know, back in the 1930s, it's not unheard of to get married or whatever at a fairly young age. I mean, they're only 2 years apart at this point. However, his eye was not the only one that Rosa had captured. Another suitor was also pursuing her, 22-year-old Pedro Garcia. Again, was the 1930s, not necessarily saying it's okay for a 22-year-old to be pursuing a 13-year-old, but it was happening. This suitor, however, approached courting Rosa in a much different way. From all statements given by 15-year-old Borja, his own courtship with Rosa was typical of any courtship in the 1930s. He claimed that the two of them were in love and that Rosa had promised to marry him and they were going to be happy. This was not to be, though, as the rival suitor, Pedro Garcia, whom Borja did not even know, had different plans with Rosa. Garcia's affair with Rosa actually came to notice of the authorities, so the police authorities first, when Rosa's own father, David Guerrero, reported Garcia for child stealing when Garcia took Rosa and headed to Mexico with her to get married. So Rosa Guerrero's own father, David Guerrero, actually reported Pedro Garcia for child stealing, they called it at this time, when the two of them were heading towards Mexico to get married. A warrant was signed for the arrest of the couple, and they were actually caught on August 15th near Monolith, California, which is about 2 hours away from Kingsburg and about another 4 hours from the Mexican or the Mexico border and Tijuana, which is where I'm guessing they were heading because it is the closest city to the border and Kingsburg. Like, I don't know that for sure. That's my speculation. Like, if I'm looking for the closest spot across that, you know, border between Mexico and the United States, like, Tijuana is going to be the closest one. And they were actually apprehended, though, by Constable Alvin King of Selma. In Monolith. And Garcia was lodged in the Fresno County Jail on a charge of child stealing. Constable King later said that the Tahachupi, and it's the name of that town that in the last episode, conveniently enough, I could not pronounce, and I still count. Tahachupi. That one. They had a flood that actually happened on August 12th, which had prevented the couple from making their way to Mexico as it delayed their travel for 2 days. Otherwise, they might have made it all the way to Mexico and gotten married, but because they couldn't go anywhere because of that flood, it gave the constable time to overtake and arrest Garcia. So Garcia was held in the Fresno County Jail from August 15th to the 20th on the charge of child stealing and was accused of holding Rosa Guerrero. Now, and this is something I found interesting. Now, for reasons that I could not find anywhere, the Guerreros later consented to the marriage of their daughter and Garcia. I don't know why, considering it was her father that had reported Garcia for taking Rosa. And the only thing I can think of is based on the time period in the 1930s was that it had some kind of intimate relationship, and therefore she was seen as being what would be considered impure, and she had to get married to him because that had already happened. So the only way to fix that was to let them get married. I'm not really sure. I don't know. Like I said, that is my speculation. Please don't take that as fact. That's my speculation here. Because it actually said that friends of the Guerreros were quoted as making threats after the wedding plans were announced, assumedly due to their unhappiness with Garcia and the obvious situation at hand. 2 days after being released from jail on August 22nd, Garcia and Rosa were married by a justice of peace in Selma, California, with the full approval of Rosa's parents. So he was arrested on August 15th for child stealing, held for 5 days. And then 2 days after he gets released from jail for that, he actually marries her with the consent of her parents. It was never actually made clear at this point or any point in this whole story when Borja, Jesus Borja, the killer in this whole story, was actually made aware of the wedding of the two. So again, I can only speculate as to when that happened. And I'm going to guess it was at some point after they returned to Kingsburg, which is, I mean, a couple days, few days after they actually get married by the Justice of Peace. Because about 8 days later, the couple were married again in a second ceremony before a priest of their faith in the morning. And then they returned to Rosa's family home on Marlin Street in Kingsburg to celebrate. Their guest remained until around 2:30 p.m. And as the bridal couple and their attendants, so in other words, the maid of honor and the best man, I totally blanked there for a second, and the best man, why they all posed for a picture in front of the Guerrero's house, like right as this picture was taken, like they had the picture taken, and right afterwards, Borja emerged and rushed upon Garcia and plunged a butcher knife into his chest, stabbing him right in the heart and killing him instantly. Borja then calmly pulled the knife out of Garcia's chest and walked away. Meanwhile, Garcia fell dead to the ground before stunned bystanders were even able to reach his side, because they were just taken completely by, like, they were stunned by, like, what just happened, because it came out of nowhere. Borja, on the other hand, walked 2 blocks away to a nearby service station where he called local police and admitted to the killing. He talked to a constable, John Croft, and made arrangements for his arrest at the house next door to the scene of the murder. The constable arrived shortly, and Borja made the statement, quote, "I am the man you are looking for. I killed a man. He married my girl, and he wasn't going to get away with it," end quote. The youth was arrested and taken to the county jail. While he was in the jail overnight, he was overheard by, I believe, some of the other sheriffs or deputies, declaring himself pleased that he had killed Garcia while laughing and whistling, seemingly unconcerned about his fate. Later at trial, though, he nervously took back this confession that he assertedly made to officers, saying, "I was, quote, I was feeling so bad, my mind was a blank. Right now, I remember making only one or two of the statements you have there. If I made all those statements, I didn't know what I was talking about," end quote. So after spending the night in jail, he was turned over to juvenile court in Fresno for an inquest to determine if he should be tried as a juvenile or turned over to the DA's office for prosecution as a mature, as it said in the newspapers, or as we would say nowadays, as an adult. On the way to the juvenile authorities, Borja told authorities of the belief that the day before at the wedding party, his friends were ridiculing him and making fun of him because he had lost his young love to the older suitor, Garcia. Despite being heartbroken and in disbelief, he had still decided to attend the wedding celebration. So, like I said, we're assuming sometime before this, he did hear about it. He decided to still attend it, perhaps because he needed to see for himself that the girl that had promised to marry him was, in fact, already married to another man instead. And while he was at the Guerrero's house, he thought he saw sneering smiles on the faces of his friends and acquaintances, ridiculing him and basically laughing at him. So this, in combination with this heartache and jealousy, he snapped and killed Garcia. Just grabbed the butcher knife and just stabbed him once, got him right in the heart, pulled it out, and then turned himself in. Didn't try to run, didn't try to hide anything, nothing. So Borja appeared before the juvenile court, where they decided that he would be tried as an adult and not as a juvenile, given that he was over the age of 14. He was 15 when he committed the crime, because at this time, in order to be tried as an adult, you had to be over the age of 14. Otherwise, you were tried as a juvenile. And I don't think that there was much, like, like nowadays we have the thing where it's like sometimes you do have young kids younger than 14 that are tried as adults, depending upon how heinous their crime was. But that's kind of how this was here. During trial, he stated he did not even know Garcia at all, but that suddenly Rosa had married Garcia, and he did state the following, quote, "I just went crazy. I don't know why I did it," he told the jury over and over again. Quote, "I didn't even know Garcia, but Rosa promised to marry me. We were going to be happy. Then she married Garcia. I just went crazy. The wedding was just a blank in my mind. I don't remember how it all happened. Suddenly, I saw Rosa standing there in her bridal dress, and the next thing I knew, there was blood on my hands," end quote. Before the trial had started, the youth had said to a reporter, quote, "Am I scared? Yes, I am. And I'm sure sorry for what I did. I don't know why I did it. I must have been crazy. I didn't even know Pedro. Rosa had told me that she liked me and would marry me. I could not stand to see her go," end quote. His attorney, so Borja's attorney, had also tried to argue that Borja had the mental mindset of a 10-year-old. So during the trial, Borja's defense attorney, Tom Okawara, attempted to prove that Borja had the mentality of a 10-year-old child. Dr. Friedrich J. Konzelman, a psychiatrist at the Stockton State Capitol, was ready to testify to the defendant's mental age. But his testimony was barred when the prosecution objected. District Attorney Walton contended that the mental age of Borja had nothing to do with the commission of the offense. Under the law, those under 14 years of age are presumed to be unable to commit a crime since they cannot differentiate between right and wrong. So, basically, the district attorney, so the prosecutor, was saying, like, the mental age of Borja had nothing to do with it. Like, he's older than 14, he needs to be tried as an adult. Because right now, in this period of time, in the 1930s, under the law at the time in California, those under the age of 14 were presumed to be unable to commit a crime because they could not differentiate between right and wrong. So basically, they were saying, like, in the 1930s, if you were 14 years old or younger, you didn't know the difference between right and wrong, and therefore were unable to commit any sort of crime because you didn't know. You didn't know any better. Obviously, we've learned differently now, but that was, at that time, that was the law. However, the defense attorney was trying to argue that chronological age, so year-wise how old he was, meant nothing, but that the actual mental age of the youth was what actually mattered. So he's saying, yes, he's 15, but he has the mental age of a 10-year-old, therefore that's under 14, and he's not able to differentiate between right and wrong. However, the psychiatrist that they had on their side to testify to that fact was not able to, because Superior Judge H.Z. Austin made the decision to rule against him and agreed with the prosecution on the question of Dr. Konzelman's testimony, therefore barring Dr. Konzelman's testimony. Okawara immediately withdrew the not guilty by reason of insanity plea entered by his client several weeks before, because he didn't have his testimony to the doctor's testimony to help with that. So the defense rested its case when Dr. Konzelman's testimony was refused. District Attorney Walton closed with an argument stating, quote, "This boy is guilty of a cold-blooded, premeditated murder as this history of the county has ever seen. True, he is but 15 years of age, but he knew all the time what he was doing. He realized that this man's life was a human life, that it was murder to kill. You, members of the jury, must not, by this verdict of yours, say to the world, murder is permitted in Fresno County so long as the murderer is of tender years. If you promulgated that theory, Life would not be safe here. Jesus Borja must be treated by you as you would treat an adult. The law gives a youth special protection. That protection is sufficient and should not include the sympathy of the jury. End quote. His defender, Okawara, closed with, quote, what can ever make you believe this was murder in the eyes of the law? This boy was blind with grief at the treatment his sweetheart had received from the hands of Pedro Garcia, stricken as no person who is not a member of a Latin race can realize, did not know what he was doing. I ask you return this boy to the home of relatives where he will be given tender and loving care. Do not submit him to the horrors of a state penitentiary where all he can ever learn will be crime. End quote. So basically the prosecution is saying, you know, he knew what he was doing. It was premeditated. It was in cold blood. Like, he knew that it would be murder. Like, you can't find him not guilty or anything less than first degree murder, because then you're saying that murder is permitted in Fresno County so long as the murderer is, you know, under however many years of age, just because he's 15, etc. While the defendant is basically, or defender is basically saying, you know, how can you possibly say that this was murder in the eyes of the law? You know, he was blind with the grief and the jealousy, and not only that, the treatment, obviously, of his sweetheart, because she had been stolen. Remember, Garcia was convicted of child stealing. And he says, and there is no person who is not a member of a Latin race can realize. So there's something in there cultural wise that I was not able to find more of. But basically, I mean, there is something in there cultural wise to saying, like, this is something that, you know, it's a pride. I don't know if it's a pride thing or a cultural thing. Like I said, I don't know for sure. But he's saying basically, like, he did not know what he was doing. Like, don't punish him for doing something that he's not even aware of in the end. The case was submitted to the jury then shortly after noon. On October 31st, 1931, the jury of 9 men and 3 women deliberated 3 hours before finding Borja guilty of murder in the first degree. The verdict could mean a sentence of life imprisonment for Borja, as the state law at the time prohibited capital punishment for minors of Borja's age. The main witnesses against Borja were Rosa and then Rafael Herrera, the best man of Garcia's wedding, or at the wedding of Garcia's. It was their dramatic story of the marriage ceremony, followed by the knife attack while the couple posed for that picture, that broke down the defense. In November of 1931, the sentencing of Borja, 15, was delayed by a motion that Superior Judge H.Z. Austin committed error in refusing to allow defense testimony, especially that bearing on the mental age of the defendant. Defense attorney Okawara petitioned for a new trial. As a result, the sentencing of Borja, who was convicted by a superior court jury of first-degree murder, was continued until November 18, 1931. If Borja failed to win the new trial, he would be sentenced to life at San Quentin Jail, at which point his attorney said he would appeal. So we're jumping ahead now 5 months, to April in 1932, at which point the request for a new trial had been denied. An appeal for Borja, who by then was serving a life term in San Quentin prison for the murder of Pedro Garcia, was submitted to the 4th District Court of Appeals at Fresno without argument. Borja sought a reversal of his case on grounds that the trial judge barred evidence beneficial to his case. At this time, Borja had been confined at San Quentin since November 18th, 1931, so 5 months previous to his appeal being submitted. On May 15th, 1933, so a little over a year from the time that appeal was filed, and about 18 months since he had actually first entered San Quentin, Borja Jesus Borja passed away at 2:35 p.m. and he passed away as San Quentin's youngest murder prisoner. During his time in prison, he actively sought a rehabilitation, studied frantically, and was anxious to become a doctor and make himself a productive member of society if he was to be released one day. That chance was never to be granted of him, though. His brother, who lived in Los Angeles, was in touch with the prison doctors and knew that his brother had a fatal form of tuberculosis, which back in the 1930s was... I tried to find statistics on it and how many people it actually killed, you know, who contracted it compared to like nowadays. And like it was, there's a whole lot of different statistics and dependent upon a bunch of different things, but it was really deadly. We'll just, you know, put it that way. Especially if you're in a prison environment, you're not going to get the best medical health. So he had a fatal form of this tuberculosis. And when it was deemed by the doctors there that there was no hope for him being able to recover from this tuberculosis, efforts were being started for a pardon. So that way he could go back to Mexico and to die with his family, who had actually returned to Mexico after his conviction. And this part kind of confused me because one article I've read said that he was an orphan, but then it talks about his family. So I'm not completely sure on all that. I'm going to go with more of that orphan part was wrong somehow, because I only read it in one article. All my sources are from newspaper articles that I found from the time. And so I'm going to assume that was false information given to the media. But that just kind of shows you too how stuff back then was very back and forth kind of. But his family apparently had decided to go back to Mexico after he was convicted, and so there was an effort for a pardon for him, so that way he was able to go back to Mexico and die in Mexico, basically, so he didn't die in prison. The papers for this pardon request were actually on the governor's desk in Sacramento at the time of his death. Borja's body was sent back to Mexico to the family for his final rites. So, this concludes the case of Jesus Borja, who, in my own opinion, fits into level 2 for evil by fitting the following parameters. He would be considered a jealous lover, immature due to his age, and committing a crime in the heat of passion, no premeditation or malice involved. He acted in the spur of the moment with no attempt to cover up the crime, as is obvious by the fact that he committed it in broad daylight in front of witnesses, and the killing was not overkill. He also did not try to flee, and he actually called the authorities himself and turned himself in. And while taking a life, I want to like just reiterate this again, is of course never in any way ever okay. When defining the evilness of a crime and taking the public's perspective into mind, like I'm doing in this series, this would be perceived as less evil than the majority of murders out there, even other jealousy murders. Like, this would be like considered one of the least like evil. Like, when public would hear about this, like nowadays, if somebody heard about this, like, they'd be like, oh, geez, like that, you know, but it wouldn't be like a shock and horror type of a thing where, if it was somebody who sought revenge upon their partner's lover by decapitating them or something. And like, I get, I am not saying that what he did was okay. I want to reiterate that throughout probably all of these, you're going to hear me saying that. I am merely classifying his crime to fit into that level 2 on the 22 level gradations of evil scale. And remember that the definition of evil is based on how the public would perceive that particular crime, like how their reaction to it would be. So, like I said, do I think it was okay? Do I think it was right for him to be convicted of first degree murder? I don't. Just, there's so much that goes into it, right? And yes, killing somebody is killing somebody, but do I think it should have been first-degree murder? No, because first-degree murder usually means that you have premeditation involved, you have malice of some sort usually, especially the premeditation. The premeditation is a big thing. I do not think that Jesus Borja had any premeditation. I think that he was jealous. I think that he was heartbroken. I think he thought in his mind that people were sneering at him and making fun of him at this wedding ceremony. And I think that he snapped. I think he grabbed a butcher knife out of their own kitchen and he just acted, you know, without even thinking, stabbed him once, pulled the knife out, and then turned himself in. You know, he did it. Heat of the passion, crime of passion. That's what it was. So first degree murder, I think, was a harsh sentence to have, and not being able to have that psychiatrist or doctor kind of testify as to what his mental state might have been, I think hurt his case too. And it kind of sucks that he did die before his appeal was able to go through on any of that. So that it's just, that's where that one fits in. And like I said, I don't have a lot of information on these cases just because it's hard to find them, obviously, because it's been almost a month since I last put out an episode. And that's because trying to find ones that fit, they're not in newspapers. Thank goodness I finally found this site called newspapers.com where it has like actual old newspapers, like the entire newspaper there, and you can find clippings. And I just typed in like crime of passion, killing in the heat of passion, and thank God finally I found some cases that would fit into it. And I'm like, oh, thank you, because I've been looking for like 2.5 weeks straight. I've just been looking, and like I would get into one and I would be like, this, finally, I found one. I'd get towards the end of like researching it and something would shift. And I'm like, crap, it doesn't fit into that anymore. It's too premeditated. It's too malicious. It's too something or other. So that's that. In the next episode, like I said, I had found another episode or another case that would fit kind of into this level too, but I think it actually fits more down into a farther level that I'm going to hang on to it and kind of keep it. So that way I'm not having to find one for that particular level, maybe save myself some of this headache again. But it has a couple of more twists and turns in it, and it's a bit more information intensive. And trying to fit both of them into like one episode anyway would be pretty long. So, and I'm hoping that I can also look more at my analytics, my own personal analytics for this podcast, and be able to give you guys some updates on where I'm standing with all of those items that I don't have prepared at the moment. But in the meantime, between this one and the next one, any feedback would be very much appreciated. You guys can contact me on Instagram, Facebook, shoot me an email. Any ratings that you want to leave me on Spotify, Apple, Audible, etc., that you can, would be wonderful. I will have a link in my show notes. It's a Linktree link, and it will actually take you to a page that has all of my social links and all of the different listening platform links, and also my donation pages that I have set up. Any donations that are given, and it's going to be through Buy Me a Coffee, and you can either do a one-time donation, or I have set up on there now subscription ones, so monthly subscriptions, and those will get the extra perks that you would be getting if you had joined my Patreon page, which I'm going to be getting rid of just because of the issues that I've been having with it, and going solely over to Buy Me a Coffee. And any of those donations that are given, whether it's the monthly subscription or a one-time donation, which you can still make, those go directly to funding this podcast. It helps me to purchase books to read for research. Subscriptions to online resources that give me access to such things like newspapers, court case documents. The donations also help me to be able to purchase merchandise such as stickers that I can send to listeners, different things like that. The more funds I have, the more I'm going to be able to do that stuff. I will also be announcing the winner of my giveaway too soon. I gotta look kind of into that and figure that out more, but that will be coming also. And in my next episode, I also have a couple shout outs for some Apple podcast reviews that lovely people have given me that I didn't have in this one. But again, thank you guys for sticking with me through this whole transition into being a solo podcast and trying out this whole like series thing as opposed to just single episodes that are just like here, there. Like I'm, you know, trying to stick with this gradations of evil scale and being able to do a series itself as a whole, but each episode being its own case. And I promise that as we move higher into that scale and higher up in the numbers that we get on the 22 levels, the easier the cases are going to be to find and the more frequently and consistently I will be able to get cases produced. Like I just want you guys to know that like it's not for lack of trying on my end that these cases have been almost a month apart. It's just been really difficult to find with this first kind of section of like jealousy and impulsive kind of killings that are just, they're harder to find than you think. I thought they'd be easy. I honestly did. And they're just not. And I know I've said that about 18 times now, but I just want to reiterate that because I don't want you to stop listening because of the length of time between them. Because the length of time will be getting shorter. And I can promise you that. Any of my resources that I did use are going to be in my show notes too. I can't even think anymore. Anyway, they'll all be in my show notes too. So next time we will be talking about the level 3 on the gradations of evil scale, which is willing companions of killers, impulse ridden, and some antisocial traits. So that will be next time on Nocturnal Distractions. And I hope you guys all stay tuned in. And I hope this was an interesting love gone wrong story for your Valentine's Day evening. I love you all and have a great night.